And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line on a Friday. Yeah, we weren't planning on it. You know what? This is the same shirt that I wore in that picture where everybody else was in suits. In Louisville. Yeah, well, anyway. Sort of an informal program today. I wasn't supposed to be here. I was going to drive back from Southern California today, but I came back last night. That was an interesting thing, playing bumper cars with lines of semi-tractor trailers climbing up to, what is that, Chiriaco Summit or something like that outside of... the wind was blowing so hard, and it was either India or Palm Springs I stopped in. I guess they're close by to each other. That it hurt. I mean, the sand, it was just stinging. It was whipping so hard. It was amazing. But at one point I had 38 miles to the gallon because it was a tailwind. It's just like, woohoo! Almost turned the engine off, just let it, you know, sail all the way in. It was great. So I do not know why this particular program is called the Victory Lap Dividing Line, but Rich is pretty excited about it.
Come on, you don't know why.
Look, one of us has to be mature.
I was going to start singing "We Are the Champions."
Is my computer up here? Okay.
That's right.
There you go.
He's not a man.
There you go. Yes, yes. Some people have no earthly idea what's going on here because some of you do not go to Facebook or anything like that. But the past few weeks there has been a Facebook, what do they call it? Podcast. Well, actually it's a podcast, but podcast battle royale. 32 podcasts started off. I didn't even know about it. I didn't even know about the first round. I didn't even know who we beat in the first round, to be honest with you. But I found out in the second round where we beat The Briefing with Al Mohler, which put us into the next round against Paula Gia Radio, and that's when things started getting a little bit hairy, a little bit strange. Something. Let's. This is Clem's reaction to your song. So what I'm getting. When I'm getting pictures of the grandkids for the whole thing, but anyways, yesterday was the final round. Sheologians defeated White Horse Inn, and so it was me versus it was us versus the Sheologians. So everybody made it me versus Summer, father daughter competition, and the memes went crazy. I didn't get a chance to play games and have fun because I was working hard yesterday. So I didn't get to, you know, promote anything or do anything like that. But the memes were great. Thanks for all the memes, guys. They were absolutely hilarious, especially all the, I guess I look like Thanos, except much, much, much smaller. And so I, you know, someone even took that scene from Infinity Wars and made it versus DL versus Sheologians, where I'm sorry, little one, and chucks her off the cliff, and that's like, wow, that's vicious, very vicious, very, very vicious. But it was all done in good fun. Hopefully, everybody picked up new listeners, and that was a lot of fun. So we did have to play the the Rocky theme there at the end. That was good. So. No, you're the one that said we couldn't play We Are the Champions. So, yeah, you Knicks made that. So, and now if you ever, did you see the meme that Reformed James White Memes for 16A19s just put up? Because Summer gave a really, really nice concession speech last night.
I was deeply, deeply moved by that speech. So much so I changed my vote.
I couldn't. I would like to, but I couldn't.
Once she went and the ridiculous sweaters, I had no choice. I had to.
But the five doctrinally sound beats per minute.
While wearing the ridiculous sweater.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what they just put it up with the points of the Golden Chain of Redemption. So if you see that on Twitter or on Facebook, you'll have to grab that. So anyways, we've had some fun with it. Appreciate it. Thanks for everybody who participated. And even those of you who participated out of spite and hatred and everything else, I feel sorry for you. That's all I can say. I feel sorry for you. There was a very different attitude when it was like us against Apologia Radio or me against theologians, because we're all in the same family. It would have been great to have had the final four been Apologia Radio, Dividing Line, Cultish, and Sheologians. Then it would have been, why do we need to bother? We won. It's done. This is it. But it didn't work out that way. So thanks to everybody that was involved with that. It was a lot of fun. Now, got to get to work here because we have, why would Summer White want to FaceTime in the middle of the Dividing Line? Wait a minute. Hold on a second here. Hey, Clementine.
What?
I'm doing the Dividing Line right now. Did you take Mom's phone?
No, it's my iPad. Mom's iPad. Okay.
Okay, I bet you do. Bye. Jenny called me this morning. She had actually taken Summer's phone or her iPad, and she knows how to get into it even without. I don't know how she does it, and so I can hear Summer going, January, you can't just call people. She's calling all these different people. She may have friends in China by now that we don't know about. Who knows? So anyhow. Yes, there. Did you take Mom's phone? Yeah, there you go. it's Mom's iPad, not her phone. It's just a technical thing. It's just a small technical difference. Anyways, let's get on to some other topics here because we are taking up the time of a man who I once would normally identify on the Dividing Line as the troublemaker from Texas, but I can't any longer. I can't any longer because he is now Dr. Tom Buck, graduate of the, and I think, Tom, have you checked on the diploma? Is the word the emphasized, maybe in all caps, bold font, something like that? Because I'm starting to notice that Southern graduates tend to really emphasize the Southern Baptist Seminary, as in opposition to any wannabes.
Well, it's part of a legal name, Dr. Mueller says.
yeah, I know it is.
The only thing I've checked for is to see if the ink is starting to disappear.
Yeah, that lemon juice ink, it doesn't last very long, so you don't want that to happen. So, but congratulations, Dr. Buck, on your graduation from there. I did find it interesting that you had done most of your work in the field of the expository preaching of Hebrews. Am I correct about that?
Well, particularly looking at the book of Hebrews as an expository sermon and then evaluating how the Hebrews preacher handled the Old Testament text. So I went back and first dealt with the Old Testament text and looking at it in its original setting and what the author was communicating. Then I went and looked to see if the Hebrews preacher actually used the Old Testament text in expository fashion. So that's what I was doing.
Did you happen to tackle one of the most difficult, challenging issues that I know of in New Testament material? And that is the fact that there are places where the writer to the Hebrews, and my theory is, and I'm not sure what yours is, but my theory is this is actually a sermon from Paul that was written by Luke.
Hey, that's my theory too. I'm not joking. I told a guy this yesterday when he asked me. So
that was the conclusion I came to. And I did 85 sermons through Hebrews a number of years ago, and it's definitely Paul's theology, but it's not his language.
It's Luke and Greek, isn't it?
It is very much so. And so, hey, if you and I came to the same conclusion, that's pretty much it. That's we can just.
Yeah, we've never talked about this before.
No, we haven't.
Honestly, so yeah.
There you go. That's fascinating. But anyway, the fact is that the writer, in at least one place, and I think two places, utilizes a textual variant from the Septuagint that goes against the Masoretic text, specifically in Hebrews 10, "A body you have prepared for me." And then the variant in Jeremiah 31 and Hebrews 8, though I was a husband to them, Baal versus I did not care for them, Gaal, and Gaal becomes the Septuagint reading. Those are tough issues to wrestle with, and yet they come up apologetically a lot too. So that's just one of the.
Yeah, I didn't get past chapter 4, so I did not do the entire book of Hebrews. So I ended with his use of the Psalms in chapter 3 and 4. So I only got through chapter 4 of the book of Hebrews.
Well, then we'll just have to see what you come up with, and you finally get there someday.
Yeah, maybe so. It was a lot of work just doing what I did.
Oh, believe me, I do understand. So, anyway, you were just at the annual meeting of the Southern Baptist Convention, and so I wasn't. And, in fact, I...
I would love to take you sometime. If you want to go next year, I think that would be fun. It's in Orlando, and you could slip on up to Atlanta. Well, Amy, it's your family doesn't live in Atlanta.
No, they don't. They don't, no.
You really have no reason to go that direction.
You really, really, really want to make yourself completely persona non grata in the SBC. If you show up at the SBC annual meeting with me, I mean, that is pretty much the end of that.
Well, what I'm hoping is maybe you would become the target.
Oh, I see. And sort of take some of the pressure off you. Oh, okay.
Yes,
all right. Well, if you want to go that direction, it's great to have friends. Anyway, so
I thought that Rocky theme was for me at first. But
no,
we should do that every year because this is our third year to do a report on the SBC.
Right. Yeah. I know. So anyway, it took place this week. Obviously, there are all sorts of issues on the table in regards to what would the progress of the woke movement be, the progressivist movement that is really seeking to undo the conservative resurgence of the 80s and 90s. So in general, what was the milieu, the atmosphere like?
Well, I mean, it's kicked off with J.D. Greer and other leaders coming out on stage with wigs on and guitars doing Lynyrd Skynyrd. So,
really?
I mean, that's a great way to start, don't you think? So that's how the convention began. Interestingly enough, they wanted, I guess, play Sweet Home Alabama. That's okay. It's just it felt like a youth pastor's thing. But anyway, a poorly done one at that. But the week had a lot of good points, high points in it in a lot of respects, just regarding the fact, you know, that there was a good atmosphere throughout the week. And, of course, we were addressing the issues that had come up in the Houston Chronicle regarding sexual abuse that occurred in churches. And so, you know, I'm thankful that they addressed those things. I may have addressed some things a little bit differently, but at the end of the day, they could not go without being addressed. So the two, most of the big issues that came up, were the last day, which would have been Wednesday, with the ERLC's report, and the questions that occurred from that, and then the resolutions that came to the floor at the close of the convention.
Now, those resolutions, for those who are not Southern Baptists, you can't just go running into the Southern Baptist Convention and throw a resolution out on the table, right?
That's correct.
So
you have to have them mailed in to the Resolutions Committee I think, at least 3 weeks or so before the convention. Then the committee comes in and reviews those and determines which ones they will send to the floor, which ones they reject.
So somebody else has control over that. So if these resolutions have made it that far, there's somebody that has determined that this is worthwhile, or is there politics involved with that, or what?
The only politics is if you have your committee, but as far as I know, there could be behind the scenes. I'm probably certain that there are behind the scenes politics going on, but there's no way that we don't even know what the resolutions are, what have been submitted to the committee until they are released in the report on the last day of the convention.
So a week ahead of time, you don't know what you're going to be voting on.
No, from what I understand, and of course, you know, I'm new to some of this stuff. From what I understand, years ago, they would print them a couple of weeks ahead of time in the state papers of the convention. But now we get them the morning of. So,
wow.
Yeah. It doesn't even give you time to really digest and deal with those. That was particularly true, as we'll talk about with Resolution 9, to think of shoving that in the hands of the people and then being able to digest that for an afternoon vote. An evening vote, actually, it ended up being, is a difficult thing.
Wow. The issue, let's do the ERLC thing first, because you were involved with that, and then we'll talk a little bit about the Resolution 9 issue second after that. So, obviously, I thought it was just what? I remember seeing the link to the article that Russell Moore had written in 2007 when he was at Southern that was in the Evangelical Theological Society journal, wasn't it, Jets?
That was 2006, the article he wrote.
Okay, all right. So 2006, so 13 years ago, Russell Moore writes an article that basically says the patriarchy's a good thing. Is that the way that you can summarize that?
Oh, absolutely. He was clearly saying that the biblical understanding of patriarchy. So, you know, we want to be careful to say that not the way patriarchy may have been abused in culture itself, but the biblical view and teaching of patriarchy he saw as a good thing, because we have Abraham, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was. He made it very clear and used the word patriarchy and said we should embrace the biblical view of it.
Right. And that's not generally what you would expect in his presentations in chapel at Southeastern these days, right?
No, and you certainly makes you scratch your head when you see how he embraces, supports, and promotes Beth Moore, who is anything but that embracing that view.
Right. So you had the opportunity of asking some questions?
Yes. In fact, there were two questions. There were three questions from the floor. The third one, I don't know the individual. I was involved in the first two questions. I actually crafted them both. But Travis McNeely, who is a messenger of Woodlawn Baptist Church, I had him at one mic, and then I was at another so that both of my questions could be asked.
And what did you want to find out?
Well, we were going with a different thing that we found. There was a recording in 2007, so a year after that article. And it was a recording on a podcast with Nine Marks. And I'll quote you what Russell Moore said. He was asked specifically about whether a woman underneath the authority of a pastor could teach or preach to men. And he answered, if the Apostle Paul wanted to say that, he would have said it. Everybody in the churches remain under the authority of the pastor. It doesn't mean you now have the authority to sin, to go against the creational order. It would be very much akin to a woman saying, I'm going to commit adultery under the headship of my husband. I have my husband's permission to commit adultery. That was his quote.
Hmm.
Okay. So we quoted that to him. Then he goes on to say, nor does it allow a woman to do what is forbidden in Scripture, which is to teach or exercise authority over a man. And so we asked him, is this still your position on women teaching in the church?
And I'm sure you got a direct interactive response.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever put your thumb on a watermelon seed and tried to press it down, that's what happened. He thanked him for the question and then proceeded to act like he did not hear the question. He said, what I would say is this. He said, he says, I have very strong convictions about biblical complementarity, that God has both gifted men and women within the church, and that God is distinctively giving roles to men and women. Our Baptist faith and message, he went to that and said that confesses complementarity. And then he said, we have issues on which we all agree, issues we agree completely. There are lots of other issues we have in common agreement in secondary and tertiary levels. Then he went on to answer the question. He compared the fact that he believes we should take the Lord's Supper weekly, but he goes to a church that doesn't take it weekly, and he's happy to be there. It was an odd thing, because not taking the Lord's Supper weekly is to not do so is not a sin.
Right.
But he said a woman preaching in the church on a Sunday morning was a sin. So he tried to make it an issue about comparing it to taking the Lord's Supper weekly on a minor disagreement like that. So he just totally evaded the question. He went on for about probably a period of 3 to 5 minutes, even answering things like, I believe that every child needs a mother and father. I mean, what's that got to do with what was asked? seriously, that's what he said.
We need fatherhood. We need motherhood. Yeah.
And then he said, the idea that we're listening too much to women in the Southern Baptist Convention is not an idea that makes sense right now. Who was saying that? Nobody was saying we shouldn't listen to women more. Or it was about one specific thing.
Right.
It was about whether women can preach in a Sunday morning corporate worship service.
Right.
So he ended by saying, let's be complementarian and try to be true to complementarianism and under the faithfulness of the inerrant word of Christ. And he never answered the question. So
yeah.
that was that issue.
Yeah. So we know how that works. That's we are back into a presidential election cycle, I guess. And so we know how that works. You don't normally get direct answers to direct questions. So what question did you manage to get asked?
I was next, and that question that I asked regarded living out. And therefore, I said the following. I said, I'm thankful for how you've spoken with great clarity in the past regarding issues of homosexuality. However, your and the ERLC's endorsement of living out has been anything but clear. Your endorsement stated that the resources at Living Out were anchored in biblical conviction. And then I quoted three things the resources said, that they teach that a same-sex attracted individual is fixed in their orientation. The same-sex couples can be, quote, a healthy environment to nurture children, and that parents, quote, should have any family rule for teenagers about same-sex girlfriends or boyfriends must be the same for opposite-sex ones. So what I asked was, since these resources existed at the time of your endorsement, would you please explain the circumstances that gave rise to your endorsement that enabled you to say that those type of resources are anchored to biblical conviction? So he did not deny that the resources existed at the time. He didn't even address what those resources said, nor renounce those views that they teach. He simply went into immediately defending Sam Alberry, similar to how he immediately defended Karen Pryor last year when asked the question about Revoice. But last year, they brought up Karen Pryor. I intentionally did not bring up Sam Alberry, and he chose to do that. So he used Sam Alberry, said that he has lived his life heroically, and I don't deny that. But we didn't ask about Sam Alberry. We asked about Russell Moore. Russell Moore, Freudian slip. Russell Moore there. And we're asking why he endorsed these things. So he said, I endorse Sam Alberry. I didn't endorse his colleagues. But he most certainly did, because he gave that endorsement on the Living Out website and said these resources are anchored in biblical truth.
Mm-hmm.
He did not give a straight answer there either.
Hmm. And there are only three total questions asked, I guess.
Yes, the third question was about something else. I can't remember what it was about, to be honest with you.
Now, I think I saw something either on Facebook or Twitter, maybe both, that you have transcribed these, or someone transcribed them and put that out there so that you can read the rest of it.
There's an individual that transcribed them. If they look, it's one of the last tweets I've made today. I've made several. But one of the last ones that I did has the transcript of the ERLC Q&A.
Okay. All right. So you didn't get the answers you wanted, but I do have to, maybe the problem here, Tom, is that the answers were over our heads, because, for example, you just used the illustration of a watermelon seed.
Right.
Now, you need to understand that only makes sense south of the Mason-Dixon line, and east of the Mississippi.
Grease pig?
I'm sorry?
Catching a grease pig?
I don't know. I'm just simply saying that Dr. Malcolm Yarnell, who has taught there in your neck of the woods for a very long time, tweeted this. He said, "For years I have watched ERLC's Dr. Moore. He is perhaps the most insightful and engaging systematic theologian ever to write." Now, I missed it. Where is Dr. Moore's systematic theology? Is that available anywhere?
I think he meant to say politician.
Oh, that's a big difference for autocorrect to actually do that. No, but he said the most insightful and engaging systematic theologian ever to write. He is spiritually astute, culturally attuned, and a good speaker. He gave great leadership to SBC 2019. Now, here's the line that might help us understand why we don't understand his answers. He showed integrity in affirming theology grows. Now, I've for a long time used the phrase theology matters.
Right.
But now we have theology grows. So is that in light of the 2006 Jets article, the 2007 interview, and now the fact that there seems to be a evolution, a growth that has taken place? Is that what we're seeing here?
There's no doubt of that. In fact, I think that the reason that Malcolm Yarnell said that is because Russell Moore said throughout that the 2019 Russell Moore would like to say to the 2007 Russell Moore.
Ah.
He didn't tell us exactly what that was, but he made it clear there was a difference.
Hmm.
So he said that he was evolving. Malcolm Yarnell picked up on that.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, Malcolm Yarnell he's the only traditionalist that I know of, prominent one, that is extremely woke. But he was a Calvinist. Then he became a traditionalist. Now he's fully woke. So if anybody understands how to evolve theologically, it would be Malcolm Yarnell. So maybe he sees stuff I don't.
Yeah, that must be it. You know, and this seems to be popular in our culture. I mean, President Obama was for, and then against, and then for, and then you got evolving, and now Joe Biden, you know, Hyde Amendment for years and years, but now no longer. And so I guess that's just how it works now, is that you need to evolve and change, and everybody knows that I'm being somewhat facetious, and that there are people who truly do think that the best theology is a theology that never has any final form to it. So when you have the emergent church folks, it's frightening to think about the fact that the attitudes that we see amongst some of the emergent church types are now starting to be enunciated by people we never, ever, ever expected to utter words like that. But, theology grows.
One thing we know is 1 Timothy 2:12 to 14 has not evolved. And it's clear. Now, people do all kinds of hermeneutical gymnastics with it. But the reality is that that scripture has not changed since 2007. What's changed is Russell Moore.
Now, I didn't get a chance to see the McKissick-Askell debate. I started a section of it, but I've just been very, very busy this week. And I think you didn't get to see it either, right? You were stuck?
No, I made it in finally. I got there.
Oh, okay. But do you remember any of it? Because you were up pretty much all night.
I do remember it. It was, I think people should watch it. I think it's informative on a variety of levels. I thought that Dwight McKissick represented his position well, and I'm not saying in the sense that I find it compelling at any level, but just regarding how he presented it in the opening was well. I thought he fell apart and the wheels came off during the cross-examination, which you have always said that's where the wheels do come off usually in debate.
Yep, and that's what happens.
I think it's worth watching because of that. It was unfortunate that he got a couple of times flustered and said some statements that were, well, I'll just say unfortunate, because at one time he made the statement that I think that he thought ultimately that we white men just didn't want women leading us.
Oh, my.
So there were a couple of pejorative type statements like that that were very unfortunate. I think if Dwight had an opportunity to rethink it and had not just been flustered, that he wouldn't choose to say those things. And I'm sorry that he did. I really am. But he made another statement later on similar to that.
Well, that's what cross examination does, though. It's not an easy thing to do. People watch people do it, and it seems like it would be easy to do. But once you get into it, you find out how challenging it really is. And so I'm going to try to find time to listen to it. I was at 65 hours worth of stuff to listen to when I left for California. I listened to stuff all the way driving to and from California, and now I have 70 hours, so it's just not fair. It just keeps growing as people say, you need to listen to this, and here's a new book there, and that's how it works. But you know how that goes. So what was your final takeaway, Tom, on where do you see the convention? Well, what's next year? Because J.D. Greer, it's normally a two-year thing, right?
Yes, so he's present until next year, then Orlando will meet there. I think it'll be a big one. Obviously, I was unprepared for Resolution 9. And
oh, we didn't even get to that. I'm sorry. Forgive me.
Critical race theory and intersectionality, and that's one of the things I'm very – I don't think that's a good sign, but it could be that it might be – you know, I told some guys this morning, this could really be a gift, actually – because we can begin to help people see where we've been saying things are going, and this is not a good sign at all, but it might be helpful for us to begin to get people to wake up, no pun intended, with the woke movement. But
okay, so the fundamental objection to Resolution 9 was that it identifies critical theory and intersectionality as useful tools of cultural analysis. Is that the terminology that was used?
Yeah, they said they're analytical tools that are useful to aid us in evaluating a variety of human experiences. So what they were saying that, I mean, it does clearly say, if you read it, that it cannot trump scripture, that anything that it says that's against God's word, that God's word trumps it. So essentially, so if you read it just from that standpoint, there is enough, if you will, to take care of that. The problem is that it's not enough to alert people to the issues of what critical race theory and intersectionality is. So, for example, they said in one of the first whereas in the resolution, critical race theory and intersectionality have been appropriated. Now, listen, it's appropriated by individuals with worldviews that are contrary to the Christian faith. So I spoke against this from the floor, and I said the truth is they weren't merely appropriated, but originated with those who hold unbiblical worldviews. Now, I'm certainly not the smartest guy in the room, but I was able to see at least that. I don't think most of the messengers know that that's the case.
Right.
That's misleading. And I would recommend everybody listen to the briefing by Al Mohler this morning. He points out that same issue. I also went on to say that they say it's incapable of diagnosing man's problems. And I came out and said it's incompatible with the gospel. I said critical race theory and intersectionality are based upon Marxism, a godless intellectual foundation, and both include a praxis contradictory to the gospel of Jesus Christ. So our problem was it didn't say enough that the messengers were voting on something that they didn't understand, not because they're ignorant or incapable of understanding, but they're ignorant of the issues. They don't know what the issues are.
Right.
It was rushed in on the floor. They literally limited us to 10 minutes of debate.
Hmm.
It was late in the hour. They had it as one of the last resolutions. Everybody wanted to go to dinner. Tom Askell offered some amendments to strengthen the language. They voted that down, and then they pushed this through. What happened is the people distrusted the committee.
Hmm.
It really is a troubling thing. It injects into the system of the SDC this kind of language. And my greatest fear is what the social justice warriors will do with this document. They'll use it as a shield. And every time that we point out that their intersectionality and cultural race, critical race theory issues that they're pushing, every time we call them out on that and show how it's unbiblical, they'll just say, well, that's your opinion. And the convention has already said that's useful analytical tools, and they'll just have a shield and a cover to push their social justice agenda.
Hmm. Is that how resolutions can function within seminaries and things like that?
Well, resolutions aren't binding.
Yeah.
So it's interesting about this because I've been criticizing, obviously, this resolution. Others have criticized it. I have spoken directly to leaders in the SBC who reluctantly voted for it, and now they regret having done so, that this was just a bad resolution. But what we constantly hear is, I've heard it multiple times today, that resolutions don't mean anything. They're not binding. This is no big deal. 5 minutes later, the same people are going, everybody needs to read the resolution we made against sexual abuse.
Right.
We're so glad this was made. So which is it? The resolutions, are they important? And the press needs to pay attention that we made a resolution against sexual abuse, which I think is important. Or are they unimportant? And the resolution about critical race theory and intersectionality, oh, just don't look here. Nothing to see. Move along.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, well, I know there was some confusion as to who authored it and what their intentions were and the editing and stuff like that that we can't get into right now. But there is no question that I would imagine the vast majority of delegates, would not be overly familiar with the background of critical theory. It is a worldview. It's not an analytical tool. It's a worldview, but it's a non-Christian worldview. It's antithetical to the Christian worldview. And, the relationship that has to intersectionality, as well, that's still new stuff for a lot of us. And so to rush something like that through without providing a primer or some reading or something like that seems strange to me. It really, really does.
I agree. And several people have, as I said, in leadership in the SBC have said the same thing, that we were asking people to vote on something they didn't understand.
Yeah.
And when I heard about these things a year ago, I had no clue what they even meant or what they were. I still struggle to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
It takes some bright minds to get and understand these things. Now, some have made the argument, well, this is, maybe you can answer this. Maybe there's no big deal. We're making too big of a deal in this because we study, someone said, haven't you ever studied Islam to better understand it? And I just don't think that's a good comparison.
No, it's not.
How would you answer that?
No, I'm seeking to win Muslims to Christ. So if you're trying to win the people, if you're trying to win critical theorists and people promoting intersectionality to Christ, then yeah, you need to know what they're saying. But that's not what this is about. And in fact, these are people saying that this is a tool to be used in our educational system and in everything else. There's not even a comparison between the two.
Let me remind you an old tactic from long ago. We used to deal with apologetics organizations that felt using the Book of Mormon as an authoritative source to witness to Mormon was a good idea. And we stood strong against that.
And the same thing with people who want to use the Quran as to actually try to make the Quran the source of a gospel message. And we're like, no, you don't do that. So, but this situation is coming from, you just wonder, these folks didn't just get elected last year. This has been coming for a while. And I was asleep. And I think most of us were, our eyes were someplace else.
Yeah, this, if people do not see, you know, we've been saying for a long time that, for at least for the last year, that critical race theory, intersectionality, these are worldviews, they're being pushed in the church, and we kept hearing, oh, you're just overreacting, you're overreacting, now we got the resolution. And even though it still does, I want to be fair, it's still saying that scripture at the end of the day is our final authority and trumps everything else. It has opened the door, if not ever so slightly, and I think it will certainly be the camel head, if you will, under the tent. I want to tell you one last thing, because this is how the committee chairman responded to my public objection to this. I quoted Paul in Colossians 2:6-8, and where he says, "See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit according to human tradition." So I said, you know, when it came to worldly philosophy and human tradition, Paul did not tell the Colossians to work to adopt them or adapt them, but to abandon them.
Right.
His response was to that immediately was that Paul said that we're not to be taken captive by them. So he didn't say that they couldn't be used as analytical tools, essentially. And then argued that Paul, he equated what this is doing with what Paul did on Mars Hill.
Acts 17, yeah.
Your answer to those two things.
Yeah, Acts 17, yeah. In Colossians, obviously, an antithesis is set up. That it is said rather than according to Christ, not along with Christ. The antithesis is plain in the grammar of the text. So to say that, well, he didn't really mean that there is an antithesis. We should have a synthesis of these things. Always keeping scripture first is what they'll always say. Well, that ends up being the reality is something completely different. And no, that's not what Paul was doing on Mars Hill at all. People who think he was saying, well, let's say these were useful ideas, this idolatry that you were in. And I'm just going to try to incrementally get you into the truth is again, a major misreading of what was going on in Acts 17. So yeah, there's been this has been coming for a long time and now we're seeing the fruit of it. And I don't know how it's going to be stopped. A lot of people in the audience are wondering what we've been cooking in our microwaves, the dinging, and what they need to understand is that Tom and I are on the same message list, and so people are text messaging the list that we're on in regards to the social justice stuff, and so you'd hear it coming across his. And then you hear it coming across mine, and so it does sound like dingy all over the place because some other folks are out there doing their thing. So
I thought you were popping popcorn.
No, I'm watching the stuff coming across our little secret text message thing there, and that's what's I can't turn it off. I even went into settings and said no, do not play sound. It still plays the sound. So I
can't
stop.
Tried to.
Yeah. Anyways, well, thank you, Tom. I appreciate you. You're giving us some insight on what was going on there, especially since I couldn't even follow the stuff in our chat that we were just talking about. And so it's helpful to everybody else. I know that there's going to be more discussion, especially. Hey, this might actually start getting people talking about critical theory and intersectionality in the SBC. Maybe that'll result in something next year that would be good. Well, we can
That's
hope.
Why I said it may be a gift.
Yeah.
If there is a silver lining. By the way, I'm so sad that when I heard you're wearing the same shirt as the picture that I didn't have time to run real quick and slip into a suit.
Yeah, thanks a lot, guys. I should have known, man. I should have known. Hey, I was the one most comfortable at dinner, though. So it was a trade-off. Yeah. There you go. So, ding, there it is.
Yep.
All right, brother. We'll be talking to you later. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right,
God bless. All right, bye-bye. Dr. Tom Buck coming out of Lyndale, Texas there, and giving us a report on what happened in regards to the Southern Baptist Convention and all the stuff related to that, and I appreciate that. Hey, I let's change the camera here because we have about 13 minutes left. I wanted to show you what was in the background of the shot there, but what was waiting for me when I got into the office today. And here is my 1550 Stephanus. And it has been rebound by Jeffrey Rice. You can see the edge here. It says 1550. It's got his sort of trademark hubs here. But this is a leather. It's a special leather they use for antique books. It's been antiqued, so it looks like it's old, even though it's brand new. And, of course, the text is now the text is now much better. It's much safer. It will be preserved better than in the original cover, the front cover, which had fallen off. And so the spine has been better preserved. And for me, the value of this book is the text itself. And so especially the marginal material that you can see out there, because this is the 1550 Stephanus. This is where Stephanus had done one of the first. It is the first. It is the first collation, not complete collation, partial collation of a small number of manuscripts into the margins of a printed Greek text. And what this, you know, I don't remember whether the I don't think the Complutensian Polyglot had that. It may have had it as an addendum volume, but right in the same page. The point, the importance of the 1550 Stephanus is that when Beza did his work, starting, you know, 15 years or so after this, there, that compilation that Stephanus did, Beza relied upon that. But what he didn't realize is that one of the manuscripts cited here in the 1550, the Beta manuscript, he now possessed. It had been given to him. He didn't know what its provenance was. He didn't know who had had it before him. And that's what's called Codex Beza Cantabrigiensis, the living Bible of the early church. It is a highly idiosyncratic text. It's not a reliable text. But the problem is, when Stephanus would look at a variant, when Beza would look at a variant reading, if he's looking at Stephanus, he has this text. He sees the Beta cited by Stephanus, then he looks at his own, his copy of the same manuscript, and it likewise has the same reading. Now he thinks there's multiple manuscripts that have the same reading in it. And that's going to impact his thinking and his textual critical process when it's actually the same manuscript. That's one of the, you know, that's going to happen early on in the process. We're still fixing things like that. We're the work of CSNTM down in Dallas right now with Dan Wallace. One of the reasons the numbers of manuscripts that we have cataloged changes, goes up and down and up and down, is because as people like the guys at CSNTM are photographing manuscripts, they discover, oh, hey, this partial manuscript here is actually a part of another partial manuscript that's over in that city over there. So this is actually one manuscript, so the number of total manuscripts goes down by one. Or they discover, they're leafing through and discover, hey, wait a minute, this is the second manuscript they've been bound together. These are two separate manuscripts, or maybe three. So the number goes back up, and you have to assign a new number. And you know, this is the type of stuff that's going on. So we're still working on the cataloging part because the manuscripts aren't all in one place. That was far more the case in the days of Erasmus and Stephanus and Beza there in the 16th century. And just another reason why it is simply wrongheaded to say, hey, what those guys did back then, let's go back there as we seek to take on people that now have a thousand times the information that we have that we're going to rely on. And that's how we're going to do our apologetics. No, that's bad direction to go. And then I'm sort of excited because there was another book waiting for me that I knew I needed to get, called The Future of New Testament Textual Scholarship. Some of the articles in here, really important stuff, but I noticed that Dr. Gurry here at Phoenix Seminary has a chapter in here. And, of course, there is material, Klaus Wachtel, The Development of the Coherence-Based Genealogical Method, CBGM, Its Place in Textual Scholarship and Digital Editing. That's one of the main reasons I needed to have this, obviously. But there's a whole lot more in here that is going to be very, very, very useful, I think. And so that just came out and was waiting for me. Unfortunately, it's not available electronically, so it's the type where you have to sit down with the marker and not be riding a bike or doing anything else. You have to focus solely upon that. So definitely going to be doing that. Looking forward to that. And if you're, you know, there's a few geeks out there that want to keep up with stuff like that, and that's sort of important. 8 minutes, huh? Yeah, I got time for that. There is an article that I saw in Pathos that I want to get to maybe next time if I can. A Convert's Guide to Not Becoming Catholic, and which is meant tongue-in-cheek, but I want to respond to that and point out its many, many errors. But what I can do briefly is I started listening, because I did not listen to all of it, but I started listening to another Dale Tuggy debate that recently took place. And wow, it's so hard to listen to Dr. Tuggy. His arguments are just so bad. I mean, it stuns me that there are so many people that just think he's the cat's meow when it comes to arguing against the Trinity, because 95% of the time he's burning straw men, and he knows he's doing it, and pretty much openly admits he's doing it. It's just really hard to listen to. Very, very frustrating. But let me just give you an example. This is just a quick little statement here to give you an idea of what I'm talking about. This is from his opening statement.
Just a single simultaneous difference, no matter how small, proves that we are dealing with two beings and not with one.
So, if there is any difference, and he said simultaneous difference, between the Father and the Son, then we're dealing with two beings, not one. Now, he well knows, though he didn't even attempt to refute it, how important in historical Christian theology the distinction between being and person is. He doesn't bother to care to remain consistent on that. And so he knows that the orthodox formulation of the doctrine of the Trinity differentiates between being and person, and says that in the issue of being, there is only one being of God, simple, it cannot be divided, it is not complex, and therefore there is no difference in the being that is shared by the Son in his deity and the Father in his deity, or the Spirit in his deity. It's just one being. Can't be divided up into thirds or anything else. But that the doctrine of the Trinity specifically, as a part of its teaching, says that the Father, Son, and Spirit will differ from one another, or we could not recognize them. That they have taken different roles. That the Son becomes incarnate. There's so many of his arguments that are based upon approaching the Son as the incarnate one, not even recognizing the plainly biblical teaching that there is a difference temporally and historically between the Logos who becomes flesh and the Logos prior to entrance into flesh. It's extremely frustrating. That just, again, if I could, we got to find out who, need to find someone who can make these and put them on a trophy stand, okay, with a little Bic lighter up front, you know what I mean? With a little plaque on it that says, straw man award given to, and then we could have it put on there, and we could send these to people like Dale Tuggy. Someone could do this. Trust me. Well, we would have to mass produce them. That's the point you're making, yes. We would not be able to keep up with the demand. But he would have to be given numerous. He would have to have gotten 10 of them just for this one debate. Dr. Tuggy would have. Because it's just our very definition says it was the Son who became incarnate, not the Father. Oh, there's a difference. No Trinity. That's the kind of argumentation. If Dr. Tuggy actually wants his arguments to be at all compelling to Orthodox biblical Trinitarians, he hasn't even tried to step up to that level. Really hasn't. The rest of, you know, he gets into all this philosophical quackery at other points that completely begs the issue as well. But that kind of, if there's just one simultaneous, then there are two beings. That was extremely frustrating to listen to. And he really does think that he provides compelling exegesis when he doesn't even begin the process of providing compelling exegesis. It's sort of, it makes sense given his background and his training. It's not in exegesis. He's not an exegete by any stretch of the imagination, but he believes that he is and presents himself in that way. So the Unitarians, you know, I guess Buzzard's group was involved with this and helping to fund it and all the rest of this stuff. And they all scratch each other's backs as far as that goes. But man, they just do not have almost anything there at all to go with. They just simply have to create a straw man, ask certain questions, and just ignore the weight of the biblical evidence, the identification of Jesus as Yahweh, the distinction between the Father and the Son. You got to deal with that stuff. You can't just ignore it. You can't just take your philosophical categories and make that your foundation. And that's exactly what was going on in that very, very frustrating thing to listen to. I'm going to try to remember on the next program next week. I want to look at that Convert's Guide to Becoming Catholic. And then there's an article running around. And again, it just plays on our lack of knowledge of history about the term homosexual and when it developed and all the rest of that stuff. These articles play on the fact that even Christians today are simply not taught how to think logically and critically. That's where the problem lies, and we must develop those capacities and so on and so forth. So with that, folks, once again, thank you very, very much for the support during the podcast battle royale. Rich has his arms up in the other room. The crowd's going wild in the other room anyways. Hey, you know, 6 months from now, it could be somebody else. You just never know. But for now, you know, we sort of were pioneers in this field as far as podcasting. We didn't know what podcasting was, but we were doing it before anybody else was, basically, because we were poor. That's how it goes. So thanks for your support. And congratulations to Summer and Joy and Apologia Radio and Cultish and everybody else that was involved. It was a lot of fun, and we'll look forward to the next time something like that comes up. And we'll look forward to seeing you next week on The Dividing Line. See you then. God bless.